Welcome to Useful Idiots.
Welcome to Useful Idiots.
I'm Matt Taibbi.
I'm Katie Halper. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Happy Christmas.
Yontif, Christmas, Kwanzaa.
Kwanzaa, all that.
I think Hanukkah maybe already happened. Diwali, I'm not sure when that is. But the point is, what is today? It is the day to celebrate Michael Moore. Second coming.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
More.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we have a great show. More Michael Moore.
And other stuff. Other stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, we have so much of it. Let's just get right to it.
Yeah. Let's get right to it.
So we didn't talk about this last week. We should have. The Washington Post released the first part of a huge expose called The Afghanistan Papers.
Yeah.
And it's really an amazing story. And it didn't get nearly as much coverage as it should have. Just the background of what happened with this piece. The Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction, that's SIGAR.
Right.
Okay. So they did a study called Lessons Learned, where they interviewed 600 people who were involved with the Afghan invasion and occupation.
Mm-hmm.
So SIGAR was looking at what had gone wrong with the Afghan mission, basically,
right,
from start to beginning, from soup to nuts, right? So they did this whole report called Lessons Learned, and they put it out, and of course it was not complimentary. This was a couple of years ago, but the Washington Post did a smart thing. They said, hey, where's the source material? And this is a public report. We should find out what's in those interviews. So they sued twice to get hold of the raw material behind this report. And it's devastating, A, and B, completely the same as all the postmortems that happened in the 70s after Vietnam, because they found almost exactly the same things. First of all, they spent $1 trillion so far on this, which is an extraordinarily huge amount of money. And they found all kinds of cases of the money just basically being set on fire. Like in one region that's about the size of an American county, they were spending $3 million a day. And the quote on this was unbelievable. One unidentified contractor told government interviewers he was expected to dole out $3 million daily for projects in a single Afghan district, roughly the size of a U.S. county. He once asked a visiting congressman whether the lawmaker could responsibly spend that kind of money back home. Quote, he said, hell no. Well, sir, that's what you just obligated us to spend, and I'm doing it for communities that live in mud huts with no windows. So basically what they're saying with this is that the overall arching theme of this is that because they couldn't figure out any way to say that the mission was successful, they created basically bad metrics for success,
mm-hmm,
and the only metric they had ultimately was spending money.
Right, like how much money you're throwing at the problem.
Right. What were your thoughts about it?
Well, I thought that the similarity to the Vietnam War that you noted was pretty striking and troubling. And of course, the thing I thought about was how little of an impact this has made, or
right,
little of a dent it's made, and just how little it's entered the discussion. It's also interesting because the Iraq War, liberals are very kind of aligned for the most part in that it was a bad thing. This one, the Afghanistan War, has always kind of divided the left.
Right. It was the good war.
Yeah, exactly. Just like some people think the first Iraq war was the good one. They
right,
were both bad. Spoiler alert. Yeah, I mean, the way it's presented as kind of like, oh, we tried to do the right thing, but we failed, as opposed to kind of having a preordained problem.
Yeah, and so one of the things that they point out in this, and it's a constant problem with all of our operations overseas, the pattern is always the same.
Yeah.
We invade or we're invited into some territory. Because we don't have any, we're completely xenophobic and clueless and don't really understand foreign countries. We tend not to understand the language.
Right.
The only way we know how to preserve our territorial gains, whether they came militarily or whatever, is by throwing in our lot with some group of politicians,
yeah,
on the ground. We always pick the wrong people. We pick people who are corrupt. In this case, the Karzai government turned out to be, you know, rapaciously corrupt, taking bribes from everywhere. This creates anti-American sentiment, which leads to anti-American movements and guerrillas, which forces us to spend more money,
right, yeah,
which makes the problem get even worse.
Right, because we're supporting the bad guys even with even more money.
Right, and the only way we know how to deal
presence,
with the problem,
yeah,
is to just throw more resources and troops and weapons and whatever at it, which keeps the cycle. And
yes,
that's why we end up in a place for 18 years.
Yeah.
And the last year is the most bloody out of all of this in terms of civilians lost since we started counting that. So it's kind of a devastating picture overall. And yet, it's like not even on the radar publicly.
Yeah.
The other thing that's really amazing about this is the whole question of the metrics thing, just to get into that quickly. When we went into Vietnam, one of the problems we had was, how do we measure whether this is working or not? Because the what we had really done is we had essentially invaded South Vietnam to help preserve our own hand-picked dictator in the South, protect him both from North Vietnamese and from rebels in the South who opposed him, right? Well, how do we measure whether that's working or not? They couldn't figure out something. So the only thing they could come up with was how many people we were killing. And so that's why they came up with things like body counts.
Theirs, obviously, not ours.
Right, theirs.
Yeah.
Body counts, truck kills, kill ratios. So we were just telling people on the ground, we were telling generals, we don't want you to, like, here's how we're going to measure you. Send us back a number of how many people you kill, and we'll reward you or not based on those numbers. And that was basically our policy there for years, because we couldn't figure out how to measure what we were doing there. And that's exactly what happened in Afghanistan. It's not that we're measuring, you know, body counts, but we were doing things like how much military activity, what are the levels of violence locally, are the roads 300% or 200% faster, how many cows are we milking? Like, none of this stuff had anything to do with whether or not our presence there was helping or hurting. It was just counting stuff.
To justify being there.
Right.
Yeah, I really think that the United States hasn't done the right thing in terms of foreign policy since World War II. That's the last time we actually backed the right side, the good side.
Right. I mean, yeah, there's probably some individual cases, but it's just it's the same pattern over and over again. And you know,
so what do you think the solution is, though? Right. Because then you have people saying, well, we can't pull out.
We have to pull out.
We just pull out. And then the damage that is done through that is a lot less than what it is through our presence.
Yeah. See, what I think what people don't get about this is that we're making the problem worse by being there because we're so stupid.
Yeah.
Like, if we had any kind of clue about how foreign countries work, like, for instance, in Afghanistan, we've been trying to impose a strong central government in this country. The country's never had a central government, right? So it's completely resistant to that idea, and it's just never going to work. But we keep trying to force it to work by force, you know? And it's gonna force us to spend more and more money trying to make this work. And another thing, there's an incredible amount of detail in this post piece. They should really be commended for what they did. And they found all these quotes, like this one guy who was from the Special Forces, he's explaining the futility of trying to tell his leaders about how Afghanistan works. And he says, quote, "They thought it was going to come to them with a map to show them where the good guys and bad guys live. At first, they kept just asking, but who are the bad guys? Where are they?" So this is the questions they're asking after we've already invaded. It just tells you
weird,
how clueless.
Kind of a weird order to do it.
Right, yeah, exactly. All right, so
it's that time of the show.
Yeah, per tradition, we're going to have to go through the most stone moments of the campaign.
Of the campaign. And I thought that for this week, it's the holidays, we could do a special bonus So we don't really pay a lot of attention to him, and we don't want to neglect him. He's like the Grinch, who had a very traumatic childhood, according to the Jim Carrey version.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Freudian. He's so cute, the little baby Grinch that he plays, that he was. So because of that, in particular, we wanted to play a clip of Trump, right? Because we have these Stone campaign moments, and Trump, in some ways, his whole campaign, his presidency is a campaign.
Well, yeah, so he's a candidate.
He's a candidate, yeah.
These aren't campaign events necessarily,
no,
but
they are campaign adjacent.
Right.
And it's time, you know, we haven't seen the video of Trump in a while.
Right, well,
so it's time.
He's done a couple of events. He was in Hershey, Pennsylvania recently, but you know, it's not like he's out there every day. Like,
right.
You
know. Oh, and I mean on the show, we haven't shown a video of him in a while. So let's listen to what he has to say.
We have a situation where we're looking very strongly at sinks and showers and other elements of bathrooms where you turn the faucet on in areas where there's tremendous amounts of water, where the water rushes out to sea because you could never handle it, and you don't get any water. You turn on the faucet, you don't get any water. They take a shower and water comes dripping out. It's dripping out, very quietly dripping out. People are flushing toilets 10 times, 15 times, as opposed to once. They end up using more water. So EPA is looking at that very strongly, at my suggestion. You go into a new building or a new house or a new home, and they have standards on where you don't get water. You can't wash your hands practically. There's so little water comes out of the faucet. And the end result is you leave the faucet on and it takes you much longer to wash your hands. You end up using the same amount of water. So we're looking at very seriously at opening up the standard. And there may be some areas where we'll go the other route, desert areas. But for the most part, you have many states where they have so much water that it comes down. It's called rain. That they don't know what to do with it. So we're going to be opening up that, I believe, and we're looking at changing the standards very soon.
That's my favorite moment. That's definitely my favorite. Yeah,
I think it might be my favorite too. Basically, it took him too long to wash his hands once, so he wants to call
it an
airstrike.
Oh yeah, because he's a real germaphobe,
right?
Yes,
yeah.
Right. He's a real germaphobe.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So right, you can see how upset he is about the lack of forcefulness. The weak water.
Right, the weak water. He went and he tried to turn and it wasn't coming out
forceful
fast
enough.
Yeah. He was upset.
And he has to leave it on constantly, yeah.
Right. So he now, of course, he's the president of the United States, so he has to throw the authority of his office at the problem of the water that didn't come out.
Water pressure, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There's some deserts, but mostly there's enough water.
Right.
As he pointed out, people are flushing toilets 10 times, 15 times, as opposed to once.
As opposed to once.
Yeah.
Right. Probably he had to flush too many times.
Yeah.
So maybe he's talking about...
Maybe he's revealing something about himself.
Right. I love the fact that he feels free to just kind of...
Riff.
Like, riff about this topic in front of the... Like, he's kind of nuts, but
I know,
it's
totally
awesome.
Nuts, yeah.
That goes to the top of the list.
Yeah,
for
I agree.
Me, I think. It's... Oh, I don't know. It's that or big structural Bailey.
Those are tied for me.
It's close. We'll put it to a poll.
Yeah,
all right.
We'll
what else
poll,
we
yeah.
have?
There's a Joe Biden one. This one's a vintage that I just really want to look at. Because, again, it's the holiday season. This is a kind of like a bonus-ish episode. So we're not playing by the rules as much as we usually do. The relevant thing is just to listen. As always, it's to listen to Biden.
And I also am told that, Chuck Graham, state senator, is here. Chuck, stand up, Chuck. Good to see you. Oh, God love you. What am I talking about? I tell you what, you're making everybody else stand up, though, pal. Thank you very, very much. I tell you what, stand up for Chuck.
Do you know what happens there?
Yeah, no, the guy's in a wheelchair.
Thank you, pal. Yeah. You can tell I'm new.
This is his Bob Barker impersonation.
It's so amazing.
Plunging into the crowd.
I love the way he says, God bless you, though, when he realized. So he tells a guy who's in a wheelchair to stand up.
Yeah.
Like a preacher, kind of. But he didn't realize he was in a wheelchair.
Right. Or his brain just.
Or his brain went elsewhere for a second.
It just goes. What did he say? He's like, I'm reaching for the answer and it's just not there, right? So, yeah, that was a Biden classic. If we were actually to go through all the Biden things, we'd be here till like 2023.
Well, what I like about it is, though, he's not the same, because then he was very quick on his feet. He would go from gaffe to like rescue,
right?
So like there he says, stand up. Oh, well, God bless you. Everyone else, you're making us stand up. Everyone stand up for Chuck.
Right.
So it's like he's being kind, somewhat masterful.
In this election cycle, he would pop his collar up, turn around, and walk away from Chuck.
And maybe insult him.
Right, yeah. Hey, fat.
Hey, fat.
Yeah,
so sedentary.
Let's do some push-ups.
Yeah, let's do some push-ups, Chuck.
Yeah, from your chair.
Yeah.
No, that was a good one.
Yeah.
I think the Trump one's going to win.
I know, the Trump one's the best, yeah. Are we going to vote on this?
Yeah, we're going to put this to a vote. So go on to Twitter, at KT Helps, Adam Taibbi. We'll vote on this, and then you'll see the full list
the results,
afterwards.
Yeah.
All right, terrific. So let's talk to Michael Moore.
Have you seen this poll? It's not gotten much notice. From the West Virginia Democrats in the first year did a poll. They wanted to know, had it not been Hillary, had it been Bernie, had it been Trump versus Bernie head-to-head. So West Virginia is the state that Trump won by the largest amount margin. 68% of the vote versus Hillary was in the high 20s. It wasn't even close.
Not a lot of Hillary voters in West Virginia. Yeah.
Granted. So it was low. It was really, really low. 68% for Trump. They did a poll, the West Virginia Democrats, a Bernie versus Trump. The result, 48% for Bernie, 46% for Trump. Trump goes from 68% of the electorate to 46 if Bernie had been the candidate.
Yeah.
But don't you think that, I mean, that makes, I mean, when I go out on the trail, what I hear, I think there's a lot of similarity between what the complaints are in Bernie crowds versus what they are in the Trump crowds.
Yes.
I mean, there's a lot of angst about the same things. There's a lot of anti-establishment feeling.
They will say that this whole system is rigged.
Yeah.
Right.
It's all rigged. It feels fixed. The fix is in, and the fix is not in for me.
Right.
And the question, the difference between them is whose fault it is and what to do about it.
Well, this is why I personally think that's why I think Bernie has the best chance
exactly,
of winning.
Exactly, yeah.
That I wish people would get over whatever their problems are with Bernie. You know, he has the best chance to inspire this base to come out, to duke it out with Trump. And, you know, and since his heart attack, I'm telling you, he's been on fire. I don't know if you've been around him at all, but he's less grumpy. He tells jokes. He's funny. He did that Between the Two Ferns thing with the Bernie impersonator.
Oh yeah, with James Domian. Yeah,
yes, this is so hilarious.
Yeah.
It's like, so funny.
Bernie never would have done that before.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
they probably cleaned out all his arteries.
Yeah.
His wife said to me, he said, you know, they go out on a morning walk every morning for an hour, okay? For an hour.
Yeah.
And she can't keep up with him. She says, I can't keep up with him.
That's,
Since the arteries are cleared out, he's like moving so fast. He's the healthiest he's been. He's, look at his posture on the stage. And he's not Statler and Waldorf up in the balcony with the Muppets. You know, the two old grumpy guys. And
they
God,
were great, though.
But I'm just saying that the kids, the Quinnipiac poll this past week, 52% for Bernie. I forgot who number two was, but that person was 30 points less than Bernie. 52% of our 18 to 35-year-olds want Bernie. And the millennial candidate,
right,
who you think some of them would be for, 2%.
Yeah, he's all at the bottom. Yeah.
He's at the very bottom.
But somehow the media keeps talking about him like he's surging, like he's at the front of the...
No, I think, first of all, I just want to say, I got to meet Greta Thunberg there a couple months ago, and she was here in New York, and I was pretty knocked over by her righteous anger at boomers and the older generation, that we have left her and her age group with the world that, you know, a world that I won't see the collapse, you know, probably not in my lifetime. You two are going to see it, a goodly chunk of it, but those kids, that 16-year-old girl, that 12-year-old boy, they know that they are fucked. And who fucked them? We fucked them. And they have every right to be putting the finger right in our face. We still can't get, we get down to a certain way, like our environmental movement, you know, Bill McKibben told us 10 years ago that if we went past 350 parts per million for carbon in the atmosphere, that there's no way to turn it around. There's no way to reverse it. There's no fix. We're done. We're at 415 right now, 415 parts per million. It is over. And the environmental leaders need to come forward and say this. Somebody's got to say, we are now incapable of solar paneling and windmilling our way out of this catastrophe. And Jonathan Franzen, the author, had a great piece in The New Yorker a couple months ago saying, perhaps we need to first admit this and then start figuring out what we're going to do to protect the species, because we're going to go through another age, whether it's an ice age or whatever. Remember, there were humans before the ice age and after the ice age. All right, so what's going to happen to the... We're not going to kill the planet. Planet's fine. Planet's going to kill us. Planet's pissed at us. And the planet, because we have tried to kill it, and because it's stronger and has more weapons, once it unleashes the viruses and the various bacterias and where's our honeybees?
Right.
Has anybody seen the honeybees?
Or koalas.
You know? I don't know if we need a koala.
We do for moral... For morale.
Katie likes koalas. They're
so cute. Yeah.
So it's like a therapy bear.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, yeah. A care bear.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So. That's right. No.
But yes, I get that. I get the honeybees. No,
But the honeybees, you know, the planet won't die if the honeybees die. We will die.
Yeah.
We will die. I forget what the scientists say. It's not like years. We will die in like 16,
imminently, right?
16 months.
Yeah.
Right. One year's worth of crops is about it.
Wow.
And we are gone.
We should be setting up mixers for honeybees.
Yes.
Right.
But just the things like we do nothing about the solar flares and the solar storms. Let me just to bum people out even more here. The last time a solar storm made it through our atmosphere and fried things. Well, there wasn't really anything to fry because we didn't have electricity yet. We did have the telegraph, and that operated on a form of when you hit the thing, the Morse code on that, and went through a wire, the solar storm fried the telegraph wire. If a solar storm makes it through, it could literally fry the whole grid of the East Coast. Here's what we know and what we've been told. We have no backup grid, number one. So it will take about a year and a half to build a new grid. Without the grid, without the electricity, humans can go a month without eating and not die. You know how long we can go without water? No water. 4 days. That's it. And you cannot pump the water. All you survivalists who might be listening to this in upstate New York, you can go out and hand pump it, I guess, but you're not going to hand pump it for how many people in New York, 29 million people in the state. There's got to be any way for us to get water into our bodies because you need electricity to pump it. There will be no grid, and there will be immediately riots, mass death, people fighting to their last breath to get water. You know, if we want to talk about the real things that we should be worried about, what's happened to our oceans? Where are the fish? These are serious ass things, and we spend no time talking about it, probably because just right now it got quiet here in the studio. Nobody wants to think about this. Please, Mike, please don't tell me this. Just tell me, how is the new season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel? Well, I'll tell you how it is. It's pretty damn good.
Yeah.
And when it gets to episode 5 and 6, it gets really good. And when it closes out at episode 8, you're like, oh. I mean, people were on the internet because they hadn't announced yet if there was going to be a season 4, begging Amazon for a season. Of course, then they announced yesterday or whatever that there's going to be a season 4.
They want another season, but they don't want fresh water.
If you want to be around to see it, right? You need electricity to be able to see it. So maybe you could link those two things together.
Wow, you're right. See, I think this is the way we have to present the problems to people. You want your Mrs. Maisel? You better start building a backup grid right now.
While you watch it.
So no storm, though, has made it through our atmosphere since 1859. That's the time it came through, fried the telegraph. But it could happen at any time. This is why I'm starting this my own media, essentially.
Yeah,
I want to be talking about these things.
Yeah. And you have an emergency. Well, we'll get into it, but then we should bring up your emergency podcast system, which is great. But yes, you're starting a new podcast called Rumble.
Rumble, right?
Yeah, Rumble with Michael Moore.
And it's great. I heard. Well, you have one episode that released.
Yeah, we just dropped it today.
It's really great, and it's funny because I was thinking about how you're talking about humor, and what's unique about this is that you kind of laugh at yourself while you're talking, because you're recalling your childhood.
Right.
And it's like an endearing another side of you. Because you're like, I don't know what I was doing. My parents gave me this tape recorder, and I was recording my grandmother reciting poems, and you were having round tables with like 9 and 10-year-olds. But
a group of 9-year-olds around the dining room table with my big Sears Silvertone reel-to-reel tape recorder, which has to be at least 30 pounds. It comes in a case with a handle, like a piece of luggage.
Right.
I mean, a 9-year-old, I could barely lift it.
So just to set it up, because I jumped ahead because I thought it was so cute. But you were gifted for Christmas, right? It was a Christmas?
It was. Well, they were worried about me because I'd been a little not talking much, having a lot of nightmares, because 4 weeks earlier, President Kennedy had been assassinated. And, of course, being an Irish Catholic family, this was a very awful, awful moment. We'd never had a Catholic president. We knew we'd never have another one again. And, in fact, we have not had another one again.
It could happen, though.
Yes. Well, yes.
You guys got the court.
The
Supreme Court.
That's true. Catholics, yeah. Well, us and the Jews.
Yeah, of course.
Up until the last one, I think, 6 were Catholics and 3 were Jews.
Cashew court. Catholic Jews.
I'm just saying that usually is not a good thing, because I've in my my TV series and shows I've had, if the writer's room is majority Catholic and Jewish, you're going to have a really funny show.
Yeah.
If you let any Protestants in,
you have to have a quota. You got to shut them out.
I shouldn't probably say that. Yeah, I'll allow. But yes, I'm not a bigot.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that if you bring too many Baptists, white Baptists, into the room, boy, it's a real buzzkill.
Yeah. The British Protestants, I mean, money, you know, the Monty Python strain of...
That's different. I'm talking about Americans.
Yeah. Okay, I see. Okay.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. It's a completely American thing.
Right.
That you want African Americans, Latinos, Jews, and Catholics in the room.
Yeah.
And some of the Latinos are mostly Catholic to begin with.
Yeah.
But so I don't know how we got onto that.
Oh, because you were saying how when Kennedy was shocked, you were there'll never be another.
So my parents were worried about me. And so my Christmas gift that year was they went to Sears and they bought a big reel-to-reel tape recorder, the old kind that you'd see only really in radio stations. But Sears was selling these monstrosities and they were... As soon as I opened it up, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And it had a little square brown microphone. And I just started recording everything. 5 weeks later, the Beatles were on Ed Sullivan. I recorded that. I started recording the kids in the neighborhood. I recorded, like you said, my grandparents. I would sit there with a microphone and just kind of, you know, record my thoughts like this. Except I had a high voice like this. and then I would start, I had my own nightly talk show. And I had my theme song that was a kind of a ripoff of the old Tonight Show song. And when they lay me down for a nap, I would just lay on the bed and put my feet and my hands up against the wall, and I'd start banging out the song. And my mom would come in and say, "You got to calm down and take your nap." Okay. And then she'd shut the door. And then on the wall, I go, ba-dum-bum-ba-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Hey, I got to take a nap right now, so we'll be right back after this nap.
It's a nap break. That is so funny. And how old were you, did you say?
Oh, geez, I started doing that one around 5.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Some of that comes through in Roger and Me, though. That whole montage at the beginning about your childhood, right?
Yes.
It's a little bit of that. Like,
well, because they were worried about me. I didn't start walking till 16 months, you know. And I tried to explain to them, because I've been that way most of my life. I'm a fairly lethargic person. I'm not inclined to want to get up and move and do anything. But I crawled backwards for months before they could get me to crawl. They'd have to move things because I would go really fast, too. I'd just zip across the room backwards. And finally, it just became entertainment for their friends. And they would have
for
all
the neighborhood.
From the neighborhood. Yes, they'd set me down on the living room floor, and then I just go in reverse, and they all loved it. I probably sensed that they loved it, and I had no incentive to start crawling forward, right? Because think about that: to crawl forward means you're going toward what? Work, or nap time, or you know, whatever the candy was, it was back there, and I was just gone. So that's how I show that in the movie, and. I didn't have any brothers. I had only sisters, and I was probably an awful nuisance to them. But I had all the things a good American boy would have. I had a machine gun. I had hand grenades. Plastic, of course. But I had all those things. I joined Boy Scouts. I won the NRA Marksman Award. So I was a normal.
You did Irish dancing.
I did. Well, and see, this is what happened. After I had that tape recorder, then the Beatles appear 5-6 weeks later. And then the next month, in March, it was 64, I decided to perform like a one-boy, one-man show on the stage at the St. Patrick's Day pageant. I got a big green top hat and a big four-leaf clover tie, borrowed the Irish cane from my grandparents' house, which is called a shillelagh. And I went up there and I started dancing and singing to this, you know, to this show tune, essentially. They must have really been worried. Because back then you didn't want to go there.
Right.
To
right.
worry about that.
The implication there.
The implication was not good.
Yeah. Right.
And but I'm up there on the stage. Oh, and I'm trying to do the Irish act. Oh, my name is McNamara. I'm the leader of the band. Let the da 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 da. There's actually home movies of this.
Wow!
Do you know where it is?
Yeah, I got to find it, but I'm gonna.
Oh, right,
I'll
by
post
St. Patty's Day
on my Rumble because it's just so crazy. So then that happens. So then the next month in April, I decide, well, the school doesn't have a school paper. I'm gonna start the school paper. This is in fourth grade.
Mm-hmm.
So I start the St. John's Eagle. I published 2 or 3 issues of it before the nuns shut it down.
Over a bad football review, right?
Yeah, it was a sports thing.
Yeah,
right?
It was like, well, we're thinking about the season next year and that we need a new coach and we need a different kind of players. And oh, my God, all hell broke loose. So.
Anti-establishment dogma. Right?
Yes, yeah. it was awful.
Yeah, exactly.
So
same thing.
Shut that down. And now let's jump ahead another maybe 12 weeks. And the President of the United States comes out on a special bulletin on TV. And he looks into the camera. He's looking right at us, Lyndon Johnson. And he says, our destroyer, the USS Maddox, in the Gulf of Tonkin off North Vietnam, was attacked by North Vietnamese gunboats. This did not happen. Right. It was made up. There were those within the Pentagon and the national security apparatus that wanted to go after Vietnam. And the war started then in full force. And within months, within the year, we had 500,000 troops there. And this all happens in this year, and I'm recording all this and capturing this audio. And I'm also starting to get pretty scared about, you know, geez, I hope this war is over because I don't want to go to a war. And by the time I'm in high school, it's not over. And there were 9 boys that came back in a flag-covered box from just my high school. 3 of them on my street. And I'm sorry, there were 2 on my street, and then there was one a block over. I didn't understand it. I didn't understand any of it. And my dad, who had been in the Marines in the South Pacific during World War II, you know, eventually he lasted till he was almost 93 years old when he passed away a few years ago. He was so upset at Bush, at the war. No faith or trust or respect for anybody who's never been to war, who would send other people's kids to war when they know nothing about it.
Well, you've talked about a lot. You talk about infinite war, right? But it's almost like not really an issue now. I mean, it was a huge issue in the early 2000s, you know, with the Iraq. Now we have combat operations in God knows how many countries, what, 7, 8 ongoing, and it's barely even an issue.
Well, look at last week with this Afghanistan papers came
right.
out.
We just talked
Nobody
about
is talking about it. But again, this is why, okay, I've got to do this podcast. I've got to do some other things online with video, with you know, real journalism. I'm sort of putting this all together now in a way that's will be very unique for the way I would do it, not the way other people would do it. But my way, at least I hope, is a way to reach middle America, to reach the place where I come from, to reach people that are not didactic or they don't have they don't call themselves Democrats or Republicans. They just want a break. They want some relief from this struggle of trying to live from paycheck to paycheck, from this statistic that came out this past year that the majority of Americans do not have $500 available to them, that if a loved one died across the country tonight, they don't have the money to go to the funeral. They literally don't have it in their pocket, don't have it in the bank, don't have it anywhere. The fact that it would get to this, where my dad comes out of the war, he has a high school education, and we grew up a union family, and the health care was 100% free. There's no copay, there's no deductible, dental, all free, eyeglasses, free, 4 weeks paid vacation. He works on an assembly line making spark plugs. 4 weeks paid vacation. And he was home at 2:30.
Wow.
Work started at 6 a.m. and it went for 8 hours. At one point, they were actually paid for their lunch, the lunch time, that half hour or so. They didn't take that out. And so he really worked 7.5 hours and a half hour for lunch, out at 2, home at 2:30. You know, everybody ate together, had dinner together. My mom, who had taught me to read when I was 4 years old by reading the front page of the paper, was such a gift to me because I could, I could read. And so when I finally went to school, I was in first grade, and everybody's singing A, B, C, D, E.
Right.
I'm reading books. And so I'm bored as hell. And the nuns saw that and wanted to move me up. You know, move me up a grade or two. And my parents wouldn't let them. They're like, no, he's to be with his own.
Yeah.
His own age. It's not a good idea. And, I was so bummed out. I thought this was the best thing, you know, to be up there with the older kids. So I had to go back and fake like I was singing A, B, C, D, F, G. A bored kid like that is trouble, I'm just going to tell you. And the poor nuns, I think back to them now and love them dearly, but they had to put up with me. So that paper that got shut down, I started it three more times by the time I was out of eighth grade.
Right.
I wasn't going to not do this newspaper, and they weren't going to stop me. And then
you did it for real later on, right?
Well, then, yes. Yeah. And then, yes, by the time I'm, let's see, that paper started when I was 22. So I started the Flint Voice then, and then did that for 10 years. And then the people at Mother Jones saw this paper that I was doing, and they offered me a job to be the editor of Mother Jones. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I could move to San Francisco, be the editor of Mother Jones. And I'd done this for 10 years, and I thought, okay, yes, I'm going
to
do this.
So is Rumble, I mean, not to bring it all the way back, but it sounds like this is going to be that same vision. You're going to do it your own way.
Yes. I'm going to say the things that other people are afraid to say. I don't have any bosses. I don't have any backers. I don't have any investors. I don't have anything but myself and Basil, who is the real kind of mastermind behind this thing. Over there, a Palestinian American. I think
who could pass for Jewish.
who could pass?
He could, right? He's from Westchester.
We have, well, yes. He's worked on my films since longer than a decade, and yes, I think we've used them for Jewish, Italian, Italian works.
Yeah.
We had the idea the other day. We haven't tried Libyan.
Oh yeah,
but
got it. You got to do that. No,
but Basil. So, you know Basil.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who knows Basil loves Basil.
Yeah,
he ran HuffPost TV.
HuffPost Live. Yeah,
there for a few years. But I'm serious. He really is a driving force. He and I are doing this. My sister came into town to help me launch it. That's it. That's all I got. I got Basil, me, some family, and
Basil and me.
I have a niece. I have a niece and the husband, the man she's married to. And I got another niece. And am I leaving out anybody? Oh, yes, we found a really good editor.
Oh, good.
A podcast editor.
Yeah.
Who does podcasts. It was really, man, he's so fast. This is a lot easier than trying to make a film. And that's one of the things I decided with this, with Rumble, with the podcast, is that I could make a movie this year for the election. And it'll take a year to make that movie. And I'll have it in theaters next October. This is too risky. I can't wait till next October. I have to be out there with this information, with organization. We're going to have a political arm to this. We're going to use the media to help organize people. If I'm successful with this, there will be bureaus that are essentially cells around the country. There'll be Rumble Toledo, Rumble Tempe. Rumble.
It'll be a little bit like an indie media, but like, yeah.
A little bit of media.
Yeah.
And a little bit of, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Leave these people alone. Pay them the right amount of money. And otherwise, it's time for a Rumble.
Yeah.
And Rumble, I like the word Rumble because it doesn't really imply violence. You know, it's like if you're the CEO and you're screwing over the workers and you're walking down the street and I see you, I could just kind of leap out of the car, roll you down on the grass, and just roll you.
Yeah.
You know, rumble, a little bit of a rumble.
I like that, roll you.
Not going to hurt you.
Right.
But before I let you up, I am going to tell you to quit messing around. Why are women not paid the same as men? Somebody explain that to me. You have to start paying these women the same as men, or I'm not letting you up. That sort of thing. Now, obviously, I'm going to make sure I don't spend a whole lot of time in jail while I'm trying to do a podcast and these other things. But
acoustics are terrible, among other things.
No, yes, exactly. But actually, my goal is to have a number of podcasts on my little Rumble network.
Yeah.
And I want one of those podcasts to come from jail number 123 C block at Attica Prison. I want to hear from people that we've incarcerated. We've done something really evil by creating laws that were specified to lock up a certain group of people. They're still locked up. I loved what, was it Cory Booker said during one of the debates, that on day one he would release 17,000 people, and he sounded like he actually had the names of the people that he would remove, because all he'd have authority over would be federal prisons.
Right.
But anybody who's in there for drugs, you're out.
Yeah.
You are maybe a threat to yourself, But you mostly need help.
Yeah.
You could do a podcast with a phone call.
Yeah.
That's one way you could do it. Right? You couldn't. It would be almost impossible to do it any other way. But they can't stop them from being on the phone.
Yeah, I'm going to do things like that. I'm going to bring voices out that you don't hear from. Yeah. There's a woman in Seattle who's had a blog for a few years where women are able to celebrate their abortions. Instead of being made to feel like they're something less or something awful and wrong, and how could, you know, when you have an abortion, you make sure don't tell anybody. When you're pregnant, you're going to have a baby, tell everybody. You have a shower. So, there'll be a podcast where we have an abortion shower every month or whatever. And women will tell their stories about why legal and safe abortion is good for all of us.
Yeah.
We live in a better society when women get to decide when they're going to bring a child into the world. That's where my head is at. Now, people listening to this may think this is insanity. But I want to go where an institution that is even a media institution. I mean, I listen to you guys. I watch your podcast here. So you are all over what's wrong with media in this country and how people are getting their information. And again, if I am elected president of the United States, I'm going to appoint the both of you to oversee the fixing of our free press.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
All right.
We would love to talk to you for more hours and hours, but we have to wrap up. It was great having you on. Can you tell people where they can find
Rumble?
You can find Rumble right where you find this podcast. Or, by the way, if you're listening to this or you're listening to it for the first time, because I on my social media, I asked you to please listen to this. It's called Useful Idiots. It's the Rolling Stone.
There we go.
Podcast.
The Michael Moore bump.
With Katie Halpern and Matt Taibbi. And if you are long-standing readers of Rolling Stone, you know this is one of the great writers for this magazine. I remember the mailman telling me in high school that, and this is, I used to subscribe to Rolling Stone back when it was a print. I mean, it was on paper, not glossy magazine. And he said,
oh, you mean the paper days?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It for some reason had made it into some kind of liquor store that also had newspapers from elsewhere. That's where I first saw it. And so I subscribed, and it would come in the mail late, And I remember the mailman saying to me, "You're the only person in town that subscribes to this magazine." I told Jan Winter that story. It was like,
that's great.
But the impact that had on a 16 or 17 year old at that time was enormous. And the writing was unbelievable. It was so wow.
Yeah, no, Hunter, especially in
yes.
that guy.
Yeah, can you get away with this?
Yeah.
So I encourage people to listen to this podcast. I encourage you to read Matt's writing in Rolling Stone. But thank you for having me on and for letting me talk about my new podcast.
Yeah.
It is called Rumble. Rumble with Michael Moore.
That's excellent.
We're done.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Terrific.
Wow.
You know, I learned something today.
What did you learn today?
A lot of things.
I learned that you could give the gift of a Michael Moore film to someone.
That's right.
That sounds so forced, like it's a sponsorship, but I just recommend it.
Yeah, you do, absolutely. You can go into a store where they sell
they
DVDs.
Don't do that anymore.
They don't do that anymore,
no.
Do that? Yeah, so you can just go and buy something.
Download it
on Amazon.
Yeah.
I guess you can pay for it for somebody if it's not free.
Oh, right. How do you gift it? You know what? Just see it yourself and then give someone a summary of it, and that's your gift.
Just keep watching our show.
Yeah, that's the gift.
Yeah.
Your gift should be a handwritten note which has our website on it.
Right.
So Useful Idiots podcast, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and all that.
Absolutely. Great idea. See you next week.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.